Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, in for Marty Moscowane. If you are a smoker, you're going to have to kick the habit if you aspire to work in the University of Pennsylvania Health System. Beginning July 1, the Penn Health System will no longer hire smokers. They're not the first. Other healthcare and business organizations have already made that decision, saying it promotes a tobacco-free future and helps contain healthcare costs. Others say it's unethical, that it amounts to discrimination, to penalizing people for a habit that is really an addiction. There's concern that a hiring ban would disproportionately affect people living in poorer communities who most need the work. The debate is raging in many quarters, including the University of Pennsylvania Health System. Two teams of researchers there have written opposing commentaries recently published in the New England Journal of Medicine. We have one from each side here in our Philadelphia studio to help us drill down on this issue. David Ash is a physician and the executive director of Penn Medicine's Center for Innovation, and he co-wrote the article in favor of the ban. David, welcome to Radio Times.
Thank you, Tracy.
And Harold Schmidt is a lecturer in the Department of Medical Ethics and Health Policy and is a researcher at the Center for Health Incentives and Behavioral Economics at Penn's Perelman School of Medicine. Harold, welcome to Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
So let's just set the stage, if we could, for a moment and talk about how big an issue smoking still is, because I think many people think, gee, it's really not so much of an issue anymore with smoke-free workplaces and restaurants, and it's not such a big deal. But Harold, how big a concern is smoking still?
I mean, presently there's 20% of the population who are still smoking, so a fifth of the population smokes. There's also a noteworthy difference between different groups of people who smoke. So 40% of the people below the poverty level smoke, but only 20% of people above the poverty level. More than roughly half of people who are unemployed smoke, but only a third of people who are employed smoke. So while overall smoking isn't all that prevalent, we do see quite clear differences between people who are among the most disadvantaged in society and who are most likely to be hard hit by policies that mean they will not be able to find work.
Why is that, that there is a larger proportion of people in lower income communities, perhaps with less education? Why is there more smoking in those communities?
I think there are many reasons why that might be the case. I think one reason that we can exclude is that this is just a matter of voluntary choice. If that was the case, you would say we'd see a normal distribution of smoking across the population. But it's very plausible that if you are unemployed, if your future isn't very bright, that immediate rewards that you get from pleasures that are right here and certain have more salience for you. So for many people, smoking is a coping mechanism. You will smoke because it gives you pleasure right there and then, but it's not something that is as important for people who get pleasure out of reward they get from work through other forms of pleasure they get in other forms of life. So that would be certainly one important reason.
David Ash, why is it a good idea to implement a ban on hiring smokers at places like the University of Pennsylvania Health System?
Yeah, so just sort of pick up on some of Harold's comments. You know, he mentions that 20% incidence or prevalence of smoking in the general population. I think there's another way to gauge smoking's impact, and it isn't just in terms of how many people smoke, but also on the health burden of smoking in our communities. So we can measure smoking by the fact that 20% of the population in the U.S. smokes, but we can also measure smoking's effect by the fact that over 400,000 Americans die each year because of tobacco-related illnesses, and that that's an enormous number. And so, and I think that really underlies various companies' interests in tackling the smoking problem through any number of means. Hiring bans are one of those means, and they're part of a suite of things that companies might do to attempt to make a contribution towards a goal that, honestly, most people subscribe to, which is that we want to reduce the burden of tobacco use in our populations. Healthcare systems, I think, are on a slightly different ground because, of course, they hold themselves out as being guardians of health in many respects and champions of promoting health and providing health care. So they're on different footing than companies that aren't in the healthcare business. But I think companies in general do see themselves as parts of their communities and have a social mission as well as a mission that is often for profit.
beyond the health issues, is it not at its heart, is it an economic issue? Because we're also talking about containing costs in terms of health insurance and absenteeism and all those kinds of things that certainly organizations are interested in reining in whatever way they can.
So it's a great point. So there's no question that there are economic issues here. They are complex. And so employers are concerned that that employees who smoke may be either less productive because of smoking breaks or more costly because of health insurance than employees who don't smoke. So there's no question that there's a view that there's an economic interest in promoting smoke-free workplaces, in promoting smoking cessation, and perhaps promoting hiring bans that would limit the ability of tobacco users to join firms in the first place. So there's no hiding from the fact that there are economic interests. But there are plenty of health-related things that employers do that really aren't economically motivated, but are about improving the health of what in some sense is their family.
Do we have a sense of what smoking costs corporations, various organizations in the course of a year?
Yeah, also a great question. It's very, very hard to get an accurate number of what does a smoker cost you compared to a non-smoker. Mm-hmm. The CDC estimates that could be between $3,000 and $4,000 a year, that a smoker will cost about that much more than a non-smoker. There are a lot of things that number doesn't tell you. It doesn't tell you what does someone who used to smoke cost once you get them to quit smoking. That doesn't mean that they immediately revert down to the lower cost level. And these figures are often tangled up and confounded by a variety of other behaviors that are associated with smoking. So it's very challenging. But I think almost everyone agrees that a smoker, on average, will cost you more and cost more in terms of healthcare services than a non-smoker.
So, Harold Schmidt, we have a situation where we've got organizations saying, listen, we're promoting good health here. We are being fiscally responsible in containing our health care costs. And in the case of Penn, we're a medical organization and we ought to set the standard for that sort of thing. What's wrong with that?
So, first of all, you did mention initially that we come to opposing views on the means of how we should get less people to smoke, and that is certainly right. But I do just want to flag that I think there's no difference whatsoever between our various perspectives on the issue that the burden of it, mortality and disease attributable to smoking, isn't acceptable and something should be done about it. At the same time, I would think we really want to look at the means. Means matter morally here. It's the different ways in which we can get to the aim of not getting people to smoke. And it seems premature to me to say we have already exhausted all options. We are at the end of the road. We have tried everything. There are a lot of interventions that show how employers can productively and with support help people quit smoking. And in my view, we should exhaust those options first. And once we are really certain that there isn't anything else we can achieve, then we could think about not employing smokers. But, and that's another topic we might come onto later perhaps, that is of potentially far more policy relevance. From next year, smokers may also be charged up to $2,500 more on average for health insurance. So that, for example, would be another way in which you could say, I'm not curtailing the options of employment that are central to livelihood for a large number of vulnerable people by saying I won't hire you, but I still reflect some of the costs that I, as an employer, have to pay by putting those onto you. Personally, I also think that's a bad idea, but I am surprised that advocates of not hiring smokers wouldn't say, let's first see how that measure that will be available from next year on a much larger scale fares, and then we will think about not employing smokers. But let's take it one step at a time. Let's not go with the most aggressive approach up front. And one other thing I should mention, since you flagged in particular the difference between healthcare employees and other employees, is that healthcare employees don't make a difference when it comes to treating people what caused the disease. So there are people who do adventure sports, they're treated. There are people who do things like becoming pregnant that costs a lot. Those are all issues that have costs associated with them. Many of those we accepted as a society to pay for as part of what it means to lead a good life. So in those cases, healthcare organizations say we care for people, and we think caring for people in this situation also means helping people, firstly by employing them, and secondly, by helping them through productive and evidence-based means to quit smoking. In the end, they will also lead to a much more satisfied workforce. If you have employees who are grateful to you because you helped them kick a habit, and let's not forget, out of 10 people, 7 do want to quit smoking. Seven mm-hmm. people out of 10 do want to quit smoking. If your employer helps you achieve that goal, you're much more likely to be a happier and productive member of the workforce than somebody who lives in fear of being penalized for a habit that you don't want to have in the first place. Nor, let's think about the implications of this smoking ban that has other ramifications. If you have somebody who smokes, it encourages all sorts of snitching where people will be spying up on people and saying, oh, I saw somebody who smoked. You know, that can have all sorts of other implications that aren't good. So the bottom line is, I do understand that employers are concerned about the cost impact, but a caring employer will deal with the problem through support and not through penalties.
Well, is there a difference, though, when you talk about the responsibility that a healthcare organization has to care for people? I would think, David Ash, that there might be a distinction drawn between treating people and hiring people. Is that the case?
Well, I think so. I think it's a very good point. You know, as a clinical organization or as a physician, I'm a physician, we make very little, you know, we don't want to make moral distinctions about who we treat. We want to be open and be able to treat everybody who needs our help. That really is quite a different decision than who works in your organization. And in fact, who works in your organization can be seen in a way as how you are communicating treatment messages, because the way a healthcare system can provide health and provide to its community is partly by the services it delivers in terms of writing prescriptions, performing surgery, engaging in imaging, and partly by the messaging, tangible and intangible, that it delivers to its community. I can think of all of those things as tools that an organization devoted to health can deploy to improve the health of its community. Mm-hmm. We're at a time right now where people talk a lot about population health. They talk about accountable care. There are many, many stakeholders in accountable care. It isn't just about the doctor and the nurse and the patient anymore. It is now substantially about employers in the community. It's substantially about the mayors of large cities getting involved in health. We are seeing many, many more stakeholders decide that, you know, the health of our community is everyone's responsibility. We share in it. It is a kind of tightly woven social tapestry, and there are lots of stakeholders there, and I think this is just one more tool that we're seeing.
Harold Schmidt, go ahead.
I entirely agree that it's really important to take the broader picture here. And in fact, the Institute of Medicine has defined public health exactly along those lines. It's what we collectively do as a society to enable people to be healthy. And in that context, it just seems to me that employers abrogate their responsibility by not employing smokers. I see that it has an immediate impact on the bottom line by saying, if I don't employ smokers, I don't have higher costs. But does it help people quit smoking? I think we just don't know. And also, it's not obvious how you would evaluate that. You know, it's very plausible that an employee who smokes will just say, well, unfortunately, I can't work at Penn Healthcare System anymore, so I'll find some other job. Now, Penn Healthcare System is a great job. It has fantastic benefits that might have other implications that I think we'll want to think about. But the key thing is this an effective measure of helping people quit smoking? That, I think, is not so clear.
Well, we have much to talk about, and we'd love to hear from you as well. Maybe you're a smoker. Maybe you work with people who smokes, the person in the next cubicle, what have you. And if you've got questions about this issue, we would love to hear from you at 477-9499. That's 888-477-WHYY. Radio Times, we'll be right back.
Drexel supports WHYY. If you are at least 20 pounds overweight, you may be eligible to participate in a research study called the ENACT Project at Drexel University. This year-long weight loss study is funded by the National Institutes of Health and is designed to help adult men and women lose weight and keep it off without medication. Guidance from weight loss specialists at group meetings is included. For more information, 215-762-8400. 215-762-8400.
I'm Jesse Thorne. Lily Tomlin is strong, sharp, and funny. Certainly a force to be reckoned with. But the rah-rah shish-kum-bah type? I didn't think so until we started talking about her high school days.
Because, you know, well, ladies and gentlemen and students too, well, here's a little cheer we're going to give to you. Hands up, touch-to-touch, a touch-to-touch.
Lily Tomlin on the next Bullseye from NPR.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY. For 19 years, the Philadelphia Invitational Furniture Show has brought together patrons and artisans. Once again, the show is downtown at the 23rd Street Armory on 23rd Street, just south of Market, and runs from Friday evening, April 5th, to Sunday the 7th. Featuring modern and traditional tables, chairs, beds, textiles, lighting, and tabletop items. PIFS supports WHYY. More info at philaifs.com. The Philadelphia Invitational Furniture Show. Art you can live with.
You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moskowain. We are talking about smoking. Specifically, we're talking about a ban that is coming up at the University of Penn Health Systems. They are looking to stop hiring smokers as of July 1 of this year. And the rationale is that we're a healthcare organization. We want to promote a tobacco-free future. We want to contain our healthcare costs. There are others, however, even within that system, who say this is discriminatory, this is unethical, it's callous, and this is not going to a good place ultimately. We are talking with a pair of researchers from the University of Penn healthcare system who come down on different sides of this issue. We've been talking with Harold Schmidt, who is a lecturer in the Department of Medical Ethics and Health Policy. He's a researcher at the Center for Health Incentives and Behavioral Economics at Penn's Perelman School of Medicine. We're also talking with David Ash, who is a physician and the executive director of Penn Medicine's Center for Innovation. David was on the team that wrote an article in favor of the smoking ban. Harold wrote an article on the opposite position. So we'd love to hear from you on this topic. The number is 888-477-9499. And gentlemen, when we left off, I just wanted to circle back to a point that you made, Harold Schmidt, about whether we've exhausted every other option. Are we at the point where we need to now stop hiring smokers? And David, I put that question to you. Have we exhausted all the other alternatives?
So I think Harold made a great point, and I agree with it. I think that we should never reach for the more aggressive interventions before we feel like we have largely exhausted our other alternatives. And I think, on the other hand, people can disagree about whether we've exhausted those alternatives or not. This may sound like a bold move to have firms decide that they're going to stop hiring tobacco users, but let's put this in some perspective. So, for example, it was the early 1960s in which the Surgeon General's report on the dangers of smoking first came out. We've been at this for 50 years now, where everyone understands the dangers of tobacco, and we have been, in a sort of metaphorical sense, moving up the ladder to try to think of additional ways to reduce the burden of tobacco use within our country. So maybe I'm just impatient, but I think it's been 50 years. We still have over 400,000 Americans die every year from tobacco. It's time to take another step up that ladder. So and I also agree that we should make sure that these steps work. And so if we, as we climb the ladder, we should be testing these interventions to see if they are having the impact we want. And I think it's reasonable to anticipate that they'll have some impacts that we don't like. There will be, in some sense, casualties of these activities, and we have to decide socially whether we're comfortable with the good and the bad of these policies. And I genuinely think that there's both good and bad, a potential bad in these policies. So, you know, the idea that we've exhausted, you know, have we exhausted every other possible alternative? Well, cigarette smoking is hard to quit. And, I think the consequences are severe enough that we want to turn up the gain a little bit, and we should do that cautiously. But I also think we should do that with a kind of boldness that's focused on our purpose.
Why is smoking so difficult to quit? One of you mentioned that 70%, I think it was, of smokers want to quit, but that a much smaller percentage actually achieves it. Harold, why is smoking such a difficult habit to quit?
Well, I'm not a medical expert, so I'm not sure I'm the best person to speak to this, but the fact is it is recognized as an addiction. It is something that messes with your willpower. It is something that means your actions aren't entirely voluntary. And I think precisely for that reason, it is quite difficult to say, we want to up the ante here a bit and get more people quitting. That's why we put this policy in place, so just do it. If it was a matter of just doing it, more people would be doing it. If 7 in 10 people want to quit smoking, why is it that they don't do it? Out of 100 people, only 2 to 5 succeed in not smoking unaided, right? That just gives you a measure of how incredibly difficult it is to smoke. And going back to the point David made earlier, which again I fully agree with, that healthcare systems are about promoting health, I think you can do all the same things, signal that you are about health, engaging people by being proactive and supporting people in smoking cessation. In fact, I think that is precisely what a healthcare employer should do and what they do in many other aspects of patient care. We want to engage patients. We want to work with them, not against them. But saying, I don't employ you means you're on your own.
And David, to that point, the University of Penn Health Systems is offering for existing employees who are smokers. They are providing free smoking cessation counseling, right? There are some options in terms of getting support with a person's effort to quit smoking.
Absolutely. And that's a critical point, which is that there are enormous numbers of efforts that are going on, not just at the University of Pennsylvania Health System, but lots of firms offer help, free help, for their employees to quit smoking. Now, some colleagues and I, in a study led by Kevin Volpe at the University of Pennsylvania, did a study at General Electric in which GE was very interested in helping its employees quit smoking. And this was a randomized controlled trial of those employees who smoked and who desperately wanted to quit smoking were randomized to receive usual care in terms of the kinds of interventions that would help you quit smoking, or that same kind of care plus a schedule of financial incentives in which employees could be paid up to $750 if they were successful at quitting. That's an example of a company working, actually paying employees to help them and giving them financial incentives to help them quit smoking. And it's I think the end of the story was a kind of part glass half full, glass half empty story. Mm-hmm. Because those employees who were randomly assigned, and this was a clinical trial, to receive financial incentives had a quit rate that was three times higher than the quit rate of the group that got the usual care, the kinds of things that most companies do. That's a great story. The sort of glass half empty part is that even with those financial incentives, that quit rate was about 9 or 10%. That meant that 90% of the employees who wanted to quit were not successful. This, I think, underlies some of my own thinking about trying to find ways to climb the ladder and do some things that might be more aggressive, in fact, that are more aggressive, to help people and help communities reduce the burden of tobacco.
Harold Schmidt.
I think that study is enormously rich in many ways because it really exemplifies so many of the issues that are at stake here. So we have a study that adheres to the most rigorous scientific standards. It has won the prize for research into practice by the British Medical Journal. A big employer had interest in rolling this out to its employees because although I agree 10% is, you know, somewhat low, it is still, let's not forget, twice as high as all attempts that people make at smoking cessation all by themselves. So you have helped a lot of people achieve something that is incredibly hard. And one thing that I think we can also learn from the study is that it shows again how incredibly hard it is to quit smoking and that we should therefore maybe be more cautious about more draconian measures. But another thing that the study shows is that when General Electric found out about the results of the studies, they indeed wanted to roll this out to their 150,000 employees and said, this is great for us. You referred earlier to the cost of smoking. If you're going with something like $4,000 a month, they're thinking $750 isn't too much. That is worth it for us, and we can promote our employees' health. But what happened is that a lot of the non-smokers said, hang on, I have not been smoking all my life. Why are you giving these people, who they might regard as health sinners of some form, money for doing something that is just plain wrong? So then the company said, well, what do we do now? We have this good evidence. We want to move on getting helping people smoking. And what they did is they turned the carrot into a stick. And they just said, well, instead of giving them $750, we'll make smokers pay $650, I think, more. So without any kind of evidence of the sort that Kevin Volpe and colleagues have contributed initially, and had they made the case to the employees to say, look, you also stand to gain from this. If more people quit smoking, we will all have lower costs. They will also affect your premiums. You could have achieved a lot. And I think it goes very much to the heart of the moral issues that are at stake here, that many people have very optimistic views of personal responsibility that play into this, where they're thinking, look, I don't smoke, I can do it, you should be able to do it too. And it's not realizing that many people grow up privileged. Many people grow up with a silver spoon in their mouth, and many don't have a silver spoon, but still grow up in much more privileged situations than others. And that's, I think, a key point to bear in mind here, that we need to realize that it's a lot harder for other people to go through their normal everyday life, and we make it a lot harder for them if we don't even give them employment.
Let's go to the phones. We have a number of people who want to weigh in on this. We'll start off here in Philadelphia with Liz. Welcome, Liz, to Radio Times.
Hi. Can you hear me?
We sure can.
I just wonder how far you're willing to go. So 20% of people smoke, 60% of people are obese, and they have similar impacts on the healthcare system. So are you going to say, no, we're not going to hire you either because you're heavy? And I think it's really upsetting for me when I go to a nurse and she takes my blood pressure and she weighs 300 pounds. However, I don't think that she should lose her job because of that.
Well, Liz, thank you for raising that point. And David Ash, I ask you, where does it end?
No, it's a great question, and it's a common question and a very reasonable question. You know, if tobacco is today, what's tomorrow? And is it obesity? Is it alcohol use? Is it a sedentary lifestyle? Is it poor diet? You know, what exactly is next? Are we on some sort of slippery slope? And I think it's a reasonable concern, but I personally would say this, which is that none of those activities is in the same league as tobacco. None of those other conditions or activities is the evidence base for its dangers anywhere near the evidence base of the dangers of tobacco, and in no case is the effect size of the danger anywhere near the same thing as tobacco. So it isn't just that tobacco is just another one of those activities that we engage in that isn't so healthful. Tobacco is in a league of its own. It's a threat on its own, and I think one could say that it needs to be treated very distinctly from any of those other activities.
Harold Schmidt, would you agree with that?
I would, but in a way that I'm not sure supports this perspective, because it is also in a league in its own in its addictiveness. So although we may say that some food habits show the signs of addiction, it is medically only recognized that tobacco is an addiction. So given the impact on voluntariness, I think that complicates very much the idea to say, and this is why it justifies us to go further here. Apart from that, I fully agree with Liz here that it raises again the question, what do we do in these other cases, and should we be penalizing people across the board there too? And as I mentioned earlier, health reform has introduced this provision to increase the amount of penalties that people may face if they don't meet certain health targets. So again, from next year, while previously people could be charged with up to more than 20% of the cost of coverage, so that was around $1,000 based on the average cost of coverage. From next year, that has been increased to 30%, and as I mentioned, for tobacco to 50%, in part because of the burden of health impact that we have here. But it raises precisely that question, what is the basis for doing this, and to what extent are these activities under the voluntary control of people? And we do have a real problem if we hold people accountable for factors that are beyond their control.
David Ash, what do you say?
Yeah, so I think there are a lot of great points in that. I mean, nicotine is highly addictive. There is no question about that. And a lot of the ethical issues in this particular context surround the nature of personal responsibility and one's ability to overcome habits. So if nicotine is very addictive, I think there are two ways to look at that. One is that it's not under your control, and therefore policies that would attempt to insist that you stop using it are very challenging for some groups. I would also say that I could have turned that around and said if nicotine is so addictive, then maybe we actually need even stronger policies. Mm-hmm. For example, why would we be selling this stuff if it is so incredibly addictive? So in my mind, you can't have it both ways. You can't say that we can help people quit tobacco with lesser means and at the same time say, but it's so addictive that you can't have policies that make personal choice part of the equation.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that because we want to go to the phones in a moment. But Harold Schmidt, go ahead.
Well, no, I just thought David raised the broader issue, which I think is precisely important here. So, and David, I wonder, do you think that it's okay for Philip Morris not to employ smokers? You know, because it does seem to me we can do a lot more things in broader public health interventions than blame it on the individuals who use the substances. Or, you know, say the current debate around visible advertising of tobacco in shops. So there's evidence that shows that this really helps, particularly for uptake of smoking of children, in preventing this from happening. And 80% of people who smoke have started before they were 18. So those are all measures, I think, in which we can really help with the overall game goal of reducing tobacco use without blaming it on the victims who are the addicted tobacco users.
I would love to see Philip Morris develop a policy that in which they will not hire smokers. So I hope that if you're listening out there, go for it.
You heard it here first. Let me go to Kevin calling from Philadelphia, because Kevin has a question that is along the lines of what we've been talking about, I think. Welcome, Kevin, to Radio Times.
Hi, good morning to everybody. Let me just preface what I'm going to say by this, to say that I do respect the right of people who smoke, because that's their right. And if 20% smoke, then that's their right to do so. But why don't we, speaking of boldness and caution, why don't we just get the courage as a country to say that's illegal? Because I'm rarely the smartest guy in the room, trust me. However, I know stupid when I hear stupid. If no one disagrees that this is a horrible, terrible thing that weighs on our economy, our health, and everything else, why don't we just develop a 15, 20-year plan to say, that's it. After 20 years, this will be illegal. And then anyone affected by it should be taken care of. If you're 50 and you're in that industry, you'll be gone out of industry. If you're just getting into that industry, maybe by the savings, we can retool or retrain those people. And if you're not born yet, of course you're not going to direct your newborn kids anything to do with that industry. So why don't we just send people to represent us that actually represent us? Because this is crazy that we keep having this conversation when we all know that this needs to go away. And well, we need to just make it illegal. Why don't we just do that? I mean,
Kevin, you've raised a great question there, and I want to give our guests an opportunity to tackle that. Harold Schmidt, what do you say? Why don't we just make it illegal? Give people plenty of time to, you know, figure out how to get out of that habit of smoking, and we'll just save ourselves a lot of money and save a lot of health problems as well.
Well, I think it goes precisely to the question of what else can we do and what other measures are there apart from looking at the individual users and blaming them for them. I think part of the explanation for why that isn't going to happen is because it is a very profitable industry. The tobacco lobby is very active. I recommend viewers or listeners this film, Thank You for Smoking, which is a great, entertaining, but also, sadly, a realistic portrayal of the cynical activities of this industry. If you equally think of a lot of the states that have in place laws that ban employers from not hiring smokers, those are oftentimes pushed through by the tobacco industry, oftentimes in association with the American Civil Liberties Union, which the listener, Kevin, just now referred to, also the fundamental value of liberty that is at stake here. So there is a collision of interests that pushes a lot of these activities, and what's at stake is that it's a powerful industry that has its own interests at heart and won't make that happen. But clearly that is something that would get rid and would be the most drastic version of doing this. And if you compare it to other forms of harm caused by drugs, smoking is, you know, again, in a league of its own, as David said earlier. So if it was possible, you know, that would make sense, but I think it's going to be very difficult given the current climate that we have and the extent to which the tobacco lobby is interwoven with the political sphere.
David Ash, I want to give you an opportunity to respond to that when we come back from our break. We are talking about smoking or hiring bans on people who smoke. One is about to go into effect at the University of Pennsylvania healthcare system. We're talking about whether that's a good idea or not. We'd love to hear from you as well when Radio Times comes right back.
PIFA supports WHYY, presenting Everyone and I, now through April 7th in the Kimmel Center's Hamilton Garden. Azuka Theater and the American Poetry Review mount a new play based on Frank O'Hara's poem, The Day Lady Died, inspired by the death of Billie Holiday. This intersection of elegy and love letter explores the poet's character and his love for Holiday's music. A Kimmel Center production, sponsored by TD Bank. Tickets at PIFA.org.
On the next Fresh Air, we remember film critic Roger Ebert, who has died of cancer at the age of 70. We'll listen back to excerpts of our interviews with him, including one that also featured his former TV co-host, the late film critic Gene Siskel. We remember a critic who loved movies and championed movies he loved on the next Fresh Air.
this afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Fox Chase Cancer Center supports WHYY. 52 years ago, the Philadelphia chromosome was discovered in a Fox Chase laboratory. The Philadelphia chromosome was the first specific genetic abnormality linked to a specific cancer. Fast forward to today, and Fox Chase is offering a new diagnostic test for advanced cancers. Through next-generation DNA sequencing, tumor-specific genetic abnormalities now can be matched to precision drugs. More at foxchase.org. Fox Chase Cancer Center, now part of Temple Health.
This is Radio Times on WHYY. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscowane. We are talking about a soon-to-be-imposed ban on hiring smokers at the University of Pennsylvania Health System. This decision has already been made at a number of other places, both inside and outside the healthcare industry. And there are arguments, as you might imagine, on both sides, that it is a good cost-cutting measure, it is a good health-promoting measure, but then there are those who say this is discriminatory, this really becomes a problem because it's unethical. And so we are talking with two University of Pennsylvania Health System researchers who have come down on different sides of this issue. David Ash is a physician and the executive director of Penn Medicine's Center for Innovation. Harold Schmidt is a lecturer in the Department of Medical Ethics and Health Policy. And gentlemen, when we left off, we were talking about, one of the callers had raised the question, why don't we just make this illegal? And Harold Schmidt, you had said, gee, there are a lot of economic and profit interests that are going on here, a lot of stakeholders who have a lot in the game at this point. David Ash, you were about to respond to that.
Yeah, so I think Kevin on the phone raised a great point. I think lots of us, even Harold, if I could put words in his mouth, would share the delight in a world that 15 years from now where no one was smoking. And at the same time, though, I think the idea of making it illegal or gliding to a pathway in which smoking was illegal raises all sorts of other issues. We've had experience with this with war on drugs. We've had experience with this with prohibition in the 20th century. And it turns out that there are, you know, consequences of those kinds of prohibitionist activities that we sometimes don't like, for example, the rise of organized crime in various forms. And so I think we need to be sensitive to all of these steps that we take toward a goal we might like sometimes makes us walk off a cliff. And I think that is why we need to be cautious climbing a sort of a one rung of the ladder at the time, even though we might all share the same goal in sight.
Let's go back to the phones to Burlington, New Jersey. Welcome, Ron, to Radio Times.
Hi, how you doing? Yeah, my comment is obviously, the health situation is obvious for smoking, but as far as the workplace is concerned, there's always been a strong pet peeve of mine. I don't smoke, yet coworkers, they go outside, they can have smoke breaks X number of times during the course of the day, while I'm still grinding away at my job, looking at them, relaxing for 3, 5, 10 minutes, and they'll have 5, 6. Or more smoke breaks during the course of the day. It's, the company's paying for it or somebody's paying for their downtime. I don't get those breaks. Well, I'll listen to the comment off the air, if you will.
All right. Thank you very much for your call. So, gentlemen, what do we say about that? Harold, I'll let you take a crack at that. So non-smokers are saying, hey, wait a minute, these people are getting, frequent breaks. And I don't know that this is the case with this caller, but, oftentimes that smell of smoke is clinging to their clothes, their secondhand smoke issues. What about that?
Well, I think secondhand smoke issues and bans on smoking in public places, as in fact we saw coming in at this institution too, make a lot of sense precisely because you can say state intervention or employee intervention or any intervention that forces or curtails somebody's liberty is justified if it harms somebody else's liberties. And that certainly is the case for secondhand smoke. So there, I think, is very clear evidence and a good rationale for putting in place very coercive and drastic measures. You can argue that, to a similar extent, there are harms that result for some workers who don't smoke from the activities of smokers who take breaks and smoke. Now, personally, I haven't looked in the evidence. I don't know whether it is maybe the case that overall taking a break makes them more productive. I simply don't know. I can understand that that creates a situation of envy, that it doesn't help some work dynamics. But to me, that would really be a matter of evidence. I simply don't know. I understand that psychologically, that isn't a satisfying sight.
Go ahead, David.
Well, I think the caller Ron brings up a point that we see in a lot of has a lot of manifestations of it, which is that there are smokers and non-smokers, and they have perceptions of each other, and we see that within organizations. The GE study is an example in which carrots were turned into sticks, mm-hmm. partly for that reason. There can be non-smokers who are upset with the breaks of smokers, as Ron was. And I think the point is that these are not insular events. People do see what happens with other individuals. They care deeply about it. And so many of our conceptions of morality and justice are tied up in those notions of equity, and they're very, very visible in this particular context.
We'll go back to the phones here in Philadelphia, and we'll welcome Patricia to our conversation. Hi, Patricia. Welcome to Radio Times.
Hi. How are you?
Fine, thank you.
This is my first time calling. I've been listening for years, but I actually work in mental health research at the hospital, and I know that people with mental health issues or mental illness are 50 to 75% more likely to be smokers, while people with mental illness, mental health issues are just, can easily be just as productive members of society, bipolar, anxiety, OCD, depression. And a policy like this would cut back on the ability of these people to be employed, and I don't know, consider them to be the same as other people, but that kind of is distressing for me. So I guess that's my comment, and I'll take it off the air.
And Patricia, before you go, when you say you work at the hospital, you're talking about Perelman, correct?
Yeah, I work in the medical school.
Okay, so there's a colleague. David Ash, what do you say to that?
No, I think Patricia raises a great point, which is that there are certain subsegments of the population, and individuals with serious mental illness are among those for whom tobacco addiction represents a particularly challenging problem. And in fact, in some circumstances, people, there is a view that tobacco actually can be, you know, help reduce symptoms that are very troubling to individuals. So I think it's a very sensitive comment made by Patricia that reflects the fact that these policies, although implemented always with the best of intentions, do paint with a very wide brush across segments of the population that can differ substantially. So I think it's a real issue. It's one that needs to be thought of in during the implementation of these activities. And I don't think that there are very easy answers to this. If there were easy answers, I don't think we'd be on this show at all, frankly.
Yeah, it highlights again the complexities of working through all of this. We'll go now to Trenton, New Jersey, and welcome Sheila to Radio Times. Hi, Sheila.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm calling as a patient. I've been a patient at the hospital for over a year, going through cancer treatment and other things. And as a patient, I've encountered workers who smoke. And I know that because they've been up close to my face, and I smell it. And as someone who's gone through treatment, I'm already, you know, sensitive to a lot of things. And that's disgusting. It's just horrible. So I absolutely have an issue with it. You know, maybe these people are washing their hands, but apparently not enough. And the stench is just there. And when you're sick, it's just horrible.
Well, Sheila, thank you for your call. Harold Schmidt, what do you say?
I think, you know, in fact, I had a similar situation recently when I was walking around Perrin Campus in the hospital area, and I saw somebody on a drip outside of the hospital smoking. And I thought, now, this looks really wrong. But at the same time, I thought, I don't think that person really wants to do this. It just points again to the mm-hmm. fact that we should understand this is not an entirely voluntary action. I'm not saying we have to prove that it's completely involuntary. I'm just saying, you know, in many cases, we really have to see it's a case of here, but for the grace of God, go I. In many cases, we are lucky not to be in that situation. And as much as I find that sight unpleasant, as much as I can understand this commentary, I think we always have to try and put ourselves in other people's shoes and think, why is it that they're behaving in this way? And in many ways, that isn't an act of deliberate and freely chosen performance, but something that they can't help because it's an addiction. So I understand the revulsion. I understand that this is not pleasant. But I think sympathy is what is called for in those situations much more than it will to penalize or to look down upon or to stigmatize.
Well, and not to put words in Sheila's mouth, but our caller might come back and say, well, what does that not work both ways? So could that person who is smoking not have compassion for me as a fellow patient, you know, realizing that this is something that bothers me, that could be physically harmful to me, should they not put themselves in my place?
And I think they do. That's why 7 out of 10 smokers want to quit. They just don't succeed.
Yeah. David Ash?
You know, so it's interesting. I think that so many, some of the motivation for policies like this, much of the motivation is an effort to denormalize smoking and actually to create stigma in some sense. And it's possible that that part of Sheila's comments reflect stigma. Part of it reflects disgust that she doesn't want to smell the smoke on a person who's leaning over her. You know, normally we think of stigma as a very bad thing. We don't want to be stigmatizing people. It sounds sort of like blaming the victim. On the other hand, if we say that we want to denormalize smoking and we may want to be delivering messages to communities and to future generations that about the dangers of smoking, we may be able to address a very, very important problem. And that's the problem that Harold has brought up, which is that most smokers, current smokers, want to quit. And in fact, I would suspect that most smokers wish they had never started in the first place. Mm. And, you know, I don't know what the best solution is to that particular challenge, but it seems to me that denormalizing smoking and creating social norms in which smoking is not something that young people want to take up is a step along that pathway.
We'll go back to the phones to Brooklyn, New York. And is it Ebony or is it Ebon? I can't tell. Forgive me. But welcome to Radio Times.
it's Ebon.
Ebon, welcome to Radio Times. Yes. We'll get it right.
That's okay. You know, I enjoy the conversation very much. It is, however, a bit limited. I think you should expand it to a more literary reference and look at 1984, George Orwell's brilliant book about totalitarian control. And I think the thrust of that book was that the administrators were taking over, and they were missing the beauty of life, which is its rich complexity, its details, its human frailty. I don't know if administrators even know how to translate frailty into beauty, but if you see somebody smoking and you smell that sweet perfume, there's actually a little moment of beauty there, even if you know in your heart that that person might be poisoning themselves. The point is this. It is cool to fixate on one particular frailty or another when the larger picture is ignored. Are you going to go in like a SWAT team and take out the board of directors because they're smoking cigars in the boardroom? You know, have you even wondered? Maybe they smoke too. Are they exempt because they happen to be in the inner party, as George Orwell called the inner group? You know, how about all of those suffering adjunct professors who aren't paid enough and they're so worried about getting food on the table that they pick up a cigarette to get that moment of bliss?
Hmm. Well,
what is the ratio of adjuncts to full-time professors at 10? And what are you doing about that? It just seems like you're picking on the wrong people.
All right, Ebon, well, thank you for raising those points. I want to give our guests an opportunity to respond to that. David Ash, what do you say?
Well, I think Ebon's comment is a perfect example of the principle that beauty is in the eye of the beholder. I'm not sure I share the same view of beauty, and maybe that's clear from the other comments that I've made. I think it's very reasonable for people to be concerned about, again, this is sort of like the slippery slope or what's next question, exactly how restrictive are we going to be, and does this look like 1984? To me, it doesn't. I just think it's substantially further than 1963, 50 years ago, when the Surgeon General's warning came out, and I think we're in a different place right now. It was not too long ago when there were smoking sections on airplanes, and I think that we would think that people lighting up on an airplane today, we would see that as a completely absurd notion. So I believe that there are social trends where there is a wave we are riding, and I think that if you look very far into the future or along that trajectory, you might decide that that's just a position you don't want to be in, but you might want to be in that position when you get there. And in fact, our view of what society ought to be doing changes over time, and we might want to be simultaneously flexible about that as well.
Let's talk about, I'm sorry, Harold, did you want to add to that?
Yes, just briefly. So I would also agree that not hiring smokers isn't quite at the level of 1984. And I have some sympathy, I think more sympathy than David perhaps, with the view expressed just here. But I do also think that addiction is not part of the beauty of life. I do also think that tobacco companies exploiting every opportunity to get children to smoke and things like that is not part of the beauty of life. Many people, as you know, we both mentioned repeatedly and as is obvious, do like to quit and probably regret having smoked in the first place. So it is a little more complicated than that. At the same time, it does make sense to have respect for civil liberties as much as we can. That's why we both, I think, also agreed with that it's not the right way to prohibit smoking. But we should be proactive in helping people quit smoke who want to do that. That, to me, seems to be the best way, and not employing them is, in my view, a curtailment of important access to a good life that is just a step too far.
So we've got about 45 seconds left here. Let me ask, do you know what the results were at the Cleveland Clinic? They were one of the first, if not the first, to impose a hiring ban on smokers some years ago. Do we have numbers about how successful it's been so far? David Ash?
That's a great question. I think it's a question we need to ask about all of these programs, and it speaks very much to the effectiveness, because we have, at least the argument I'm putting forth is a consequentialist one, that we'll get to a better place with policies like this. So it is very hard to evaluate the impact of these policies. The Cleveland Clinic has reported that the rate of smoking within their immediate community, within the county in which the Cleveland Clinic resides, has declined substantially more than in all of the other counties in Ohio. That is indirect, but in my mind, suggestive evidence that these policies help.
And for the other ones, perhaps, Harold, too early to tell.
I think so. But yeah. David is absolutely right. We need evidence on this, and we can't just trust that this is the right way to do it, especially if there are alternatives that we can explore first. Support and help is what we need.
Well, David Ash, thank you so much. Harold Schmidt, we so appreciate both of you coming in to help us, as I said earlier, drill down on these issues and get a better understanding of the complexities involved in this idea. Thank you so much to both of you for being with us.
Thank you, Tracy.
Thanks for having us.
You have been listening to Radio Times on WHYY, and I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscoane. Next hour on Radio